Lecture 3, How Two Neurons Communicate.
Hi, we are back and ready to resume our quest to understand the nervous system and how it produces behavior and how everything on Earth that came before that nervous system can regulate its function. What have we gotten to in the last lecture? We've looked at how one neuron gets excited, how a neuron pays a fortune to be quiet when it has nothing to say, the resting potential, how excitation comes in at the dendritic end, how very importantly that wavelet of excitation is going to dissipate over time, if and only if a whole bunch of neurons are screaming at this one simultaneously, the axon hillock has its threshold passed to generate the action potential, goes shooting down extra fast because of that myelin, and gets down to the axon terminal, and then we've got a problem. And that problem is today's lecture. We've now made a very important transition. We've now gotten to step number 2 of being a neurobiologist, which is to now draw the neurons in this much more schematic way. We've got one neuron talking to another. We're now up to 2 neurons in our diagram. And you will note there, right at the point where the axon terminal of the first neuron is reaching out to the second, something is happening there. And that is expanded in the diagram below. What you see, highly magnified, is the 2 neurons don't actually touch each other. They don't touch. Instead, there's this yawning microscopic river of extracellular fluid in between the 2 of them, something called the synapse. The synapse is the space between 2 neurons, and the synapse is basically the subject of today's lecture. Now, the whole key thing is people didn't used to know that synapses existed. Back when, in the 19th century, the basic view was each neuron connected with the next one, and thus this neuron sent its 10,000 axon terminal projections merging into the next, forming this huge net throughout the brain, and there was always this sort of cadre, this lunatic fringe of scientists who said instead, no, they don't actually touch, there's a space in between. So there were the neural net people, and there were the synapse people, and their conflict was actually sort of the central socio-political sort of debacle of the 19th century, thousands of peasants slaughtered, violent brother pitted against brother. And finally what happened was the whole debate got resolved because somebody invented a microscope that was powerful enough to see there's actually a space between the two. And thus the synapse was confirmed, and thus an entire problem was generated because we've just made this great action potential in the last neuron shooting down the line, gets to the axon terminal, and that electrical wave, that electrical signal, is not able to jump across the synapse. This huge ocean of extracellular fluid makes it impossible for an electrical signal to get across if that first neuron, if that presynaptic neuron, is going to talk to the postsynaptic one. It has to translate its electrical message into a different language. It translates it into a chemical one. Sitting in this axon terminal on the left in the presynaptic neuron, there's these little packets, these little balloons filled up with chemical messengers. Along comes the action potential, and this causes these little balloons tethered to the very end of the axon terminal to get pulled into that membrane. They merge with the membrane, and they dump their chemical messengers out into the synapse. What do they do at that point? They float across the synapse, where they have an effect on the postsynaptic neuron. On this postsynaptic neuron, there's a receptor for this chemical messenger. Now, it is absolutely required to be a neurobiologist. You have to use the following cliche. The chemical messenger that comes floating out fits into the receptor. Here's the cliche. Get ready. It fits like a key into a lock. The particular shape of the messenger and the particular shape of the receptor, they are complementary. And if and only if this right messenger fits into the receptor, that causes this dendritic spine to get excited. We have just found a means by which we go from one neuron to the next and then initiate all that electrical excitation stuff from the last lecture. These chemical messengers that go floating across the synapse are called neurotransmitters. And what you wind up having is when a neuron gets excited to the point of having an action potential sweeps to the end, and out of all of its axon terminals, it releases neurotransmitters that float across the synapse and have their message heard in the next neuron. Now, the one additional piece we need to do here in making sense of this flow of information is in the diagram at the bottom. What happens to your neurotransmitters after they bind like a key into a lock to the receptor? They come floating off, and there's a critical final step there which becomes very relevant later on. What do you do with the neurotransmitter then? Two options. You could be ecologically minded. You can recycle your neurotransmitter, and it is taken back up into the presynaptic axon terminal, repackaged again in those little balloons, these vessels, these vesicles, that's the term for them. You can recycle your neurotransmitter, or you can be ecologically unminded. You can have some enzyme, you can throw out your neurotransmitter, an enzyme sitting there in the synapse, which rips your neurotransmitter up into little pieces, flushes it down the toilet. What's your brain's toilet? Your cerebral spinal fluid, where it gets into your bloodstream and eventually into your bladder. And you can have either recycling of neurotransmitters or their degradation, their breakdown, tossing them out. Okay, so now we come to this question. How many different types of neurotransmitters do you need? You want to do something very boring with your nervous system, you don't need a whole lot of neurotransmitters. You've got your arm, and you want to pull it up, you want to activate a flexor muscle. All you need is one type of neurotransmitter that goes from your spine to this muscle, telling you to pull it up. Okay, one neurotransmitter. Suppose you want to do something more complicated. You've got your heart, and sometimes you want to speed it up, sometimes you want to slow it down. Two different directions and messages, you're up to needing two different kinds of neurotransmitters. Get into the brain and start writing symphonies and filling out your tax forms and stuff like that, and two neurotransmitters aren't going to do it. Remember, we've got hundreds of billions of neurons, each one making 10,000 synaptic connections. We've got a gazillion synapses there. Does that mean we've got a gazillion different kinds of neurotransmitters? Not at all. And all you need to do to appreciate that is think about the fact that we could generate virtually infinite number of messages having only 26 letters in the alphabet. All you need are rules for how you combine them. All you need is some sort of rule that when you take one of those letters that has sort of two lines that are angled like this and in a horizontal lane, you're talking about a letter which, if you put it sort of embedded in a C and a T, you're talking about things with whiskers, and embedded in some other combination, you're talking about existentialism. We learn rules for using the letter A in different contexts. And in the same exact way, neurotransmitter A in one part of the brain means remember to, like, turn the lights off before you go out. In another part of the brain, it makes your pancreas do its thing. And you've got multiple uses for the same neurotransmitter in different parts of the brain. And all you need are conventions in this part of the brain. This presynaptic neuron and this postsynaptic one have worked out. This is what releasing the neurotransmitter means here. And meanwhile, four counties over in another part of the brain, it has a completely different use. There's multiple forms of neurotransmitters. What you then wind up seeing is an important elaboration, which is different neurotransmitters have different powers, different strengths in what they do in the postsynaptic neuron. There's some types that are highly excitatory. What does that mean in ionic terms? What does that mean back to the last lecture? They cause a huge wavelet of excitation. They're one big boulder that you've tossed into the pond. There are other neurotransmitters that are only weakly excitatory. You've got a whole range of the strength of the message. Likewise, you've got neurotransmitters that are termed inhibitory neurotransmitters that make the postsynaptic neuron less excitable, lock it in more strongly in its resting state. So you've got a whole bunch of neurotransmitters that are yelling at the neuron, some of them saying get really excited, some are saying get only moderate excited, some are saying get really inhibited, and once again we've got the axon hillock there integrating all those excitatory and inhibitory inputs. So we've seen the need here for a bunch of different types of neurotransmitters, and the best estimates are there's a couple of hundred out there. As long as they are used in multiple ways, they can service your brain with its trillions of synapses. So now what we need to look at is, how do you construct these neurotransmitters? What are these chemical messengers like? And right at this point, if you're a first-year medical student, the entire point of the lecture now is to completely overwhelm and demoralize you with these horrendous multisyllabic terms and these awful biosynthetic pathways. And despite that, all of the neurotransmitters are synthesized with some very simple rules. and they make perfect sense. Once again, you want to use your neurotransmitters in the next hundredth of a second to run you away from the saber-toothed tiger. You don't want to spend the next 3 weeks constructing this wonderful molecule that's going to be the most gorgeous neurotransmitter on earth and you're long dead. They're used quickly. They are obsolete an instant afterward. As a result, you see a whole bunch of rules about their synthesis built around being as cheap as possible. Today's newspaper is obsolete tomorrow, and all it's good for is paper training the dog. You don't want to put a whole lot of energy into a messenger that is almost immediately obsolete. And you see this played out in a number of ways, a number of rules. First off, what do you build your neurotransmitters from? What are the building blocks, the precursors? And what you wind up seeing is they are all built from very simple, boring, plentiful molecules that you get in your diet in huge amounts, very simple amino acids, very simple constituents of fat, so that you are never, ever up the creek and trying to run for your life from the saber-toothed tiger. And oops, bad luck, you've run out of the critical neurotransmitter because you haven't had enough precursor on hand. There's a shortage this year. Very plentiful, cheap precursors. What you see is the next step there, which is you make your neurotransmitter out of this precursor, just a couple of biosynthetic steps, nothing fancy. You just make a couple of changes here and there, just so you know this isn't an amino acid anymore. This is now one of those fancy specialized neurotransmitters, just a couple of steps, nothing terribly exotic. You need to do it quickly, very cheaply. So you've gotten that far. The next trick you find is for the same precursor, depending on where you are in the nervous system, depending on which type of neuron, you could generate different neurotransmitters. In other words, you can squeeze multiple messengers out of one precursor. Another way to be really cheap, to be really efficient about your system. What's the fourth way of being efficient? We saw it a few minutes ago, which is whenever possible, even recycle your neurotransmitters. Use them over again. And that's a great way to make the whole system very cheap. So you've got these enormously fancy chemicals, which nonetheless are very simple in their principles. They are real easy to make. They're made out of cheap precursors. You squeeze a lot of different types of messengers out of one precursor and you recycle them. And that's exactly the system you would have to see where you're using neurotransmitters 20, 30, 50 times in a second across a synapse. These are not fancy molecules. They've got to be cheap, functional ones. So that's a whole lot about their biosynthesis. What you then ask is, okay, there's a gazillion different chemicals you find in a neuron, maybe even in its axon terminal. How do you decide, is this thing a neurotransmitter? What are the criteria that are used? They make perfect sense, and there are four classical ones. The first one is, you know, no surprise, if something's going to be a neurotransmitter, you got to show it's in the axon terminal. And the axon terminal contained in one of those balloons, one of those vesicles, it's got to be there. The next thing you have to show is you got to release it. Along comes an action potential, and you've got to show that this vesicle full of this putative neurotransmitter merges with the wall, with the membrane, and dumps out the chemical messenger. You send it into the synapse. The next thing you have to show is perfectly logical as well. It gets to the other side of the synapse and lock and key-ish into the receptor there, and it does something or other now to the neuron. The next one in line, the neurotransmitter is released, floats across the synapse, binds to receptors in the postsynaptic neuron, and some excitatory event changes in that neuron. Those first three criteria show you that something could be a neurotransmitter. The final criteria shown in the diagram is a critical one. If you mess with the system, things don't work normally afterward. If you throw in some drug which blocks the receptor, which makes it impossible for that key to fit into the lock, something important now no longer occurs in that postsynaptic neuron. What you've just shown is normally it serves a function. Block that function and something doesn't work anymore. You've now shown this thing as a messenger. So it's got to be there, it's got to be released, it's got to have an effect on the postsynaptic neuron, and if you block that effect from occurring, something is mighty wrong at that point. That's how you show something's a neurotransmitter. And at this point, there's maybe 20, 25 different chemicals that have met all of those criteria, and there's close to 100 others that meet a few of those criteria. You go away for a long holiday weekend, you come back the next Monday morning, and seven new things are now putative neurotransmitters. It's a very rapidly changing field, identifying these messengers. And as we'll see in later lectures, some of these neurotransmitters violate all the rules we just set up, but these are your basic off-the-rack neurotransmitters. Now, what you begin to see as the next question is, how do you wind up manipulating the system? How do you wind up beginning to see how the system can change over time? And that will actually be the subject of the next lecture, how does synaptic communication change? And you could begin to see exactly what this is about. You change the amount of neurotransmitter being released. You change the amount of receptor. You change the sensitivity of the receptor. You change how easily you do the recycling. You change how readily you have the enzyme ripping up the neurotransmitter, degrading it afterward. This is where we begin to see all those individual differences out there. We all differ in how readily we make those neurotransmitters, how readily we make the receptors. We have different versions of those receptors from one person to the next, and we're beginning to understand where those differences have consequence for behavior. We can readily see where these individual differences come from, as we will just as readily see in the next lecture, how you can change the functioning over time. We'll see it in a special case, the change of synaptic function that we call learning and memory. Now, what we focus on here is one additional important piece of how these synapses work. And this one's real important because it is relevant to the lives of a lot of us, how you can use drugs to change the functioning of synapses. Neuropharmacology, the ability of having pharmaceuticals change neural function. And this is relevant to understanding certain drugs of abuse, and this is relevant to understanding a huge number of medications out there. And what you have, essentially, is an array of ways in which you can manipulate the nervous system, manipulate synaptic communication with drugs. First example, and this is one out of the realm of substances of abuse. Here we have a synapse, and we've got all our usual components. We've got the neurotransmitters in the vesicles, we've got the synapse, we've got the receptors, we've got the reuptake mechanisms, we've got the degradative mechanisms. It just happens that this synapse is completely silent. There's nothing happening there. The presynaptic neuron hasn't had a creative thought in its head for weeks. It has nothing to say. It has no action potential. There's no neurotransmitters coming out. The synapse is completely quiet. And it just so happens this individual has ingested a drug. And the drug has a certain chemical structure to it. The drug gets into your gut, it gets into your bloodstream, it eventually gets into the brain and gets into synapses all over the place. And the critical feature is that drug has a chemical structure that is almost identical to the actual neurotransmitter. And what does it do? It comes floating into the synapse from out of left field, gets into the synapse, and binds to the receptor. And it binds so effectively and looks so much like the real thing that it fakes out the receptor. The receptor believes it has just bound the actual neurotransmitter released by the presynaptic neuron. The second neuron gets excited, gets a wavelet of ionic changes. What's going on? That second neuron is hearing voices. It's hearing voices that aren't there. This is how hallucinogens work. And there's a particular class of neurotransmitter called serotonin, and all of the major hallucinogens, chemically, their structures are just like serotonin, almost identical, and that's the case for LSD, mescaline, psilocybin. All of those artificially activate serotonin receptors when there's no serotonin being released. And as a result, you've got pathways that are getting excited when your brain had no intention of doing it. That's what a hallucination is. Why hallucinations take certain forms and have certain coherent visual aspects to them, so on, why you hear voices instead of random sounds, nobody really understands, but that's one way of chemically manipulating the synapse, send a message when it isn't really there. What's the next thing you can do? Potentially exactly the opposite. Now put in a drug that binds to the receptor except in this case, it doesn't bind in a way to activate the receptor. It just gums things up. It blocks it. You've blocked the receptor. Two examples of this. One of them blocks a bunch of neurotransmitter receptors that have something to do with your diaphragm, and suddenly your brain is not able to send a message telling you to breathe. And this proves to be fatal. What's this drug? Curare. This is how curare winds up being a poison. It blocks a class of neurotransmitter receptors, and your diaphragm doesn't work anymore, and you are up the creek. Here's a more interesting example, straight out of clinical medicine, and this is a drug which blocks a different class of receptors, a class of receptors for a neurotransmitter that we're going to hear a lot about, a neurotransmitter called dopamine. Now, where does this become relevant? In one part of the brain, it seems as if dopamine has something to do with coherent, logical, linear thinking. And if the levels of dopamine are incorrect, you've got a person with a great deal of trouble with coherent, logical, linear thinking. What are we describing? This is the psychiatric disorder of schizophrenia, a pattern of very dramatic thought disordering. And during the mid-1950s, it was discovered, throw in any of a class of drugs that block dopamine receptors, and schizophrenics get better. These are drugs, they're called antipsychotics, also termed neuroleptics, Haldol, Thorazine. Anytime in some, made-for-TV movie where somebody has their psychotic break and the orderlies come down and wrestle the guy down and they get the syringe into him to calm him down, this is most typically a dopamine receptor blocker that's being used. Okay, so you look at this. And you say, here we have this florid psychiatric disorder of abnormal thinking, of disordered thinking. Throw in a drug that blocks dopamine receptors in this person's brain, and suddenly they get less psychotic. I bet you there was too much dopamine in the first place. And that's the leading hypothesis as to the neurochemistry of schizophrenia, too much dopamine release. So that's a way of manipulating the system. Then there are other drugs that you can throw in, which what they will do here is you could be releasing neurotransmitters when you had no intention of. You can trigger the release of neurotransmitters. And that's another version of something vaguely resembling a hallucination. You are forcing the neuron, the presynaptic neuron, to send a message when it has no intention of. Other ways of manipulating the system. In this case, what you can do is change aspects of the recycling of the use of a neurotransmitter after it's done its thing, after it has bound to a receptor there. What were the two things that happened at that point? One of two choices that we've heard. You can recycle your neurotransmitter. Some pump in the presynaptic neuron grabs onto the neurotransmitter, pulls it in, and sticks it back in a vesicle. Or you can have an enzyme floating around the synapse that grabs onto the neurotransmitter and tears it into little pieces and flushes it out to sea. So you can use drugs that manipulate either of those steps. One version of it. Now we manipulate that enzyme that tears up the neurotransmitter. And this is a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine, and it's an enzyme that rips it apart called MAO, monoamine oxidase. And during the early 60s, people developed a drug which inhibited MAO, an MAO inhibitor. What does an MAO inhibitor do? It inhibits this enzyme from ripping up the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. You don't rip up the norepinephrine, it stays there longer. And what does it do at that point? For lack of anything else to do, it hits the receptor a second time and a third time and a 40th time. You boost up the norepinephrine signaling in the system. And what you see then, what people discovered in the early 60s was, you take somebody who is clinically depressed and give them an MAO inhibitor, and they start feeling better. Aha, what does your theory have to be at that point? If you take a drug that blocks the breakdown of norepinephrine, that causes norepinephrine to have more of an oomph, to send more signaling than it used to, and depressions get better, I bet you there wasn't enough norepinephrine in the first place. And this is one of the leading theories as to what's wrong with that disease. Now, the other thing we could do there in manipulating, as mentioned, is you can stop the recycling, the reuptake of a neurotransmitter. And there is a drug which these days is probably the most heavily prescribed in this country, which blocks the reuptake of a certain type of neurotransmitter, blocks the reuptake of serotonin. And only serotonin, what are these things called? Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. What's the most famous version of this? Prozac. Prozac, another antidepressant, and that causes a whole bunch of people to now think about serotonin. Aha, you take somebody who's depressed and you make it impossible for them to remove the serotonin from the synapse, and as a result, serotonin stays around longer and works more. I bet you there wasn't enough serotonin in the first place. And those are the two leading hypotheses of depression these days, a shortage of norepinephrine and or a shortage of serotonin. And in both cases, shown with a chemical manipulation of the system. Now, there's another manipulation you can do there, which is quite interesting. How about you change the amount of neurotransmitter that you make? How about you boost up the synthesis of neurotransmitter? And this is shown in another disease. Unfortunately, one that's becoming increasingly common, neurological disease of aging, Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's, motoric disease, you have trouble initiating movements, you can have a very florid Parkinsonian tremor. The best evidence since the early 1960s is Parkinson's is due to degeneration in one area of the brain that makes tremendous use of the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine, wait a second, I just heard about dopamine with schizophrenia. This is a completely different area of the brain. In this part of the brain, dopamine is about smooth movements. And what you see there is a massive loss of dopamine for reasons we're beginning to understand. The neurons there die. So what do you think? What's a good way of boosting up dopamine levels in the remaining neurons? Give them more dopamine to release. It's hard to put dopamine into somebody's gut and get into the brain. You use a precursor, something called L-DOPA. L-DOPA is a couple of steps before dopamine. Stoke up somebody on L-DOPA, and they make more dopamine in that part of the brain, and some of the Parkinsonian symptoms calm down at that point. That's been one of the leading therapies since the early 60s. So you manipulate the system, you boost up the levels of the neurotransmitter. Okay, if you are watching closely here and skeptically, you should notice there's a problem. Schizophrenia, too much dopamine. You throw in a drug that blocks dopamine receptors, schizophrenia gets better. Parkinson's, too little dopamine in a different part of the brain, you throw in a drug to boost up the dopamine levels. Where are you putting those drugs in? You're not spritzing them into this one area of the brain. You're putting it in the gut, gets into the blood where it gets all over the brain. And suddenly you should be having this aha, what's going on here in Parkinson's disease, too little dopamine, so you give the person L-DOPA, and in this part of the brain there's not enough dopamine, and you correct it, and the Parkinsonian symptoms get better. Meanwhile, in the other parts of the brain with normal dopamine levels, you push things above normal. What should you see? One of the most common side effects if you overshoot your L-DOPA level is the patient gets psychotic. And some of you will have seen the movie Awakenings, based on Oliver Sacks, and what you have there is a very rare neurological disease, stiff man syndrome, which has something to do with Parkinson's. And what you saw there was these are people who have so much of a tremor that they are frozen. And what you got there was treating people with L-DOPA, and you had this miraculous awakenings, people moving for the first time in years. And what you also saw with the Robert De Niro character there is when you overdo it, you get this florid paranoid psychosis. So try to fix up Parkinson's, and a possible side effect is inadvertently generating something that looks like schizophrenia. Meanwhile, over in the other corner, you've got the schizophrenic, and you give them the antipsychotic to block their dopamine signaling, and in this part of the brain where there's too much, you bring it back down to normal, and in the other parts of the brain, you depress dopamine signaling. What's the side effect of too much antipsychotics? You start getting Parkinsonian tremors. And there's a special name for it in psychiatry. It's called tardive dyskinesia. Kinesia, kinetics, body movement, dyskinesia, abnormal movements. And you go to some state hospital, and you go to the back ward, and you find somebody trembling there like that. And this is somebody who's been taking antipsychotics for a long time. So what we see here, inevitably, is there's no free lunch, built around the fact that the same neurotransmitter is being used in very different parts of the brain. So that gives us a sense of the workings of this. The last thing we need to do is, as usual, look at the individual differences. We've already heard about it. We differ as to the amount of neurotransmitter released, the amount of receptors, etc. There's increasing evidence of a type of neurotransmitter system very closely related to a class of drugs that decrease anxiety, drugs like Valium and Librium, and we have our own versions of those inside our brains, and it's been identified that certain rodent strains, rat strains, that differ in their levels of anxiety differ genetically as to how well the receptor binds to this Valium-like compound that begins to explain those individual differences. Okay, so what have we gotten to at this point? We have now graduated from one neuron, we're up to two neurons, and how they talk to each other. Our other theme here, plasticity, how these neuronal functions change over time, will be the subject of the next lecture. What I see now is the big hand is approaching a six, so it's time for us to shut down. What we will see after this is how synaptic communication changes in response to experience. What's the biology of learning?
Lecture 4, Learning and Synaptic Plasticity.
We are back for more on our goal to understand how biology works in shaping our behavior. And as we've started in these lectures, trying to understand that from the standpoint of how the brain works. We've looked at how one single neuron works, how it integrates an incredible number of inputs from all sorts of other neurons, how it in turn talks to the next neuron in line. Last lecture's world of neurotransmitters, transsynaptic communication across the synapse, finishing up with a sense of individual differences, how one person's synapse may work differently from another. Now, what our theme has been at the end of each lecture, twofold. One is looking at plasticity, how things change over time, individual differences. When it comes to plasticity in the synapse, how it functions differently in response to experience, that's such an important topic that gets an entire lecture today. And what plasticity means in this case is learning. How do you learn something new? How do you remember it? Remarkably enough, or maybe not so remarkable when you think about it, your brain works differently when you have learned a fact. And what we now know is somewhere in your brain, your synapses work differently. What learning is about is changes in synaptic communication. What memory is about is those changes lasting a long time. Now, people have not always understood learning to involve changes in synapses. Mainly because earlier on in neurobiology, people didn't even know synapses existed. What was the first notion, this quaint, charming idea that anytime you learned a new fact, you made a new neuron? And then people figured out adult brains don't make new neurons. That can't explain it. So the next version of charming, incorrect theories was the notion that when you learn a new fact, you form a new synapse. Either an axon terminal and a dendritic spine that weren't connected now connect, form a synapse, or you actually grow a new axon terminal. Then people figured out that was ridiculous and that was some charming, outdated idea. And what people came to realize instead was synapses that were already there work differently. Naturally, in the last decade, what people have learned, revolutions in this field, is the adult brain actually does make new neurons. And they may have something to do with forming memories. The adult brain actually forms new synapses that has completely overturned some of the dogma in the field. Nevertheless, what still remains the dominant paradigm for how learning occurs is synapses work differently. And the official jargon in the field is what learning is about is you strengthen pre-existing synapses. What does strengthen a pre-existing synapse mean if the first neuron, the presynaptic neuron, has an action potential and talks to the second neuron? It is now more likely that that second neuron will have an action potential. You have strengthened the communication between the two. And this was a notion come up with by a guy named Donald Hebb, this famous neuroscientist in the 1950s. And Hebb, basically, if you're a neuroscientist, you were not able to talk about any subject without somewhere in there saying, and it was in the 1950s that Hebb first predicted that this is how the brain was going to work. This guy predicted the next 80 years worth of neuroscience. He was the first one to say, it's not about new neurons, it's not about synapses forming anew, it's about synapses that are already there, working differently, working stronger. What learning is the strengthening of synaptic connections. Now, what people have realized is your brain is not this undifferentiated mass of tofu. There's different parts of your brain, and different parts do different things. And there's two areas that from day one have been implicated in learning and memory. We now get into our first anatomy of the entire brain. It's these two regions, one called the hippocampus, and Latin fans will recognize hippocampus means seahorse in Latin, and presumably some neuroscientist who didn't go anywhere near the seashore often enough decided this part of the brain looks like a seahorse. It actually, to me, looks more like a jelly roll, but nobody knew the Latin name for it. It's this curving structure underneath the surface of the brain. It's very involved in learning and memory. The other region at the top of the list is the surface of the brain called the cortex. All across the top, we have the cortex. The hippocampus is buried underneath a subcortical structure. These are two really important areas for making sense of learning and memory. What's the best evidence for it? Twofold. The first one is a horrendous disease, the disease that probably collectively we are most afraid of out there, disease that most polls show are more frightening to us than cancer, than HIV, than heart disease, Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease, which melts away your brain, melts away your capacity to learn new things, access memory, and overwhelmingly Alzheimer's disease is a disease of the hippocampus and the cortex. The other strongest bit of evidence comes from a man who's probably the most famous patient in the history of neurology. This is a guy who is only known by his initials, HM, and he winds up in every single textbook. HM had an extremely rare type of epilepsy when he was a kid, before any of the modern drugs existed. The epilepsy, the seizures tended to begin in his hippocampus. He was having multiple seizures per day, and in an extremely desperate and radical move, his hippocampuses were surgically removed. The only time this has been done to a human, and it mostly solved his epilepsy, and since then, HM has had a 30-second memory capacity, and then everything is gone. An amazing story in and of itself, but this is some of the evidence, along with Alzheimer's, that shows hippocampus and cortex is what learning and memory is centered in. These are the parts of the brain where experience causes synapses to be strengthened. And the particular jargon used in the field is you potentiate the synapse, you make it work more strongly. This potentiation is long-term. That's what the memory is. Thus, the jargon is long-term potentiation, LTP. That's the jargony term for synapses working stronger in response to experience and remembering it. Now here, we see, sort of on a schematized version, what happens during LTP in this diagram. We are recording from some dendritic spine, and an arrow here represents a point where you stimulate it. You dump some neurotransmitter on, and as we know by now, we get our little wave of excitation. Now what you do is you potentiate that synapse. You stimulate it over and over and over and over, 20 times a second for a certain number of seconds, even faster. This cluster of arrows, you stimulate that synapse like crazy. Then you wait a bit, and you stimulate it again, and something amazing has occurred, as shown here. That little wavelet of excitation is a lot bigger than the previous time. You have potentiated that wave of excitation. This is now a more excitable synapse. The signal coming out of the presynaptic neuron makes the second postsynaptic neuron more excitable than it used to be. You get a greater likelihood of an action potential occurring. Now, the really amazing thing is you take a break from your experiment and you go out and you take a nap for 3 weeks and you come back after that and you check out that synapse and it is still potentiated. The potentiation is long-term LTP, and for lots of people out there, this is the nearest thing to what's going on during learning and memory. At first, it was thought this is a great model for strengthening a presynaptic of pre-existing synapses. What is now pretty much accepted is this is no model. This is what goes on during learning. And what's come to be realized is even though LTP was first identified in the hippocampus, then the cortex, that's ground zero for learning and memory, it occurs all over the place in the nervous system. One example. There's another part of the brain called the amygdala, and we will hear about that in later lectures. The amygdala has something to do with fear, with trauma, and the right type of stimulation, the right time of trauma, the right type of trauma, and you get long-term potentiation in the amygdala. What do you get then? You have just conditioned a phobia. You have just conditioned something like post-traumatic stress disorder. You now have an amygdala that's hyper-excitable. There's parts of your spine that undergo LTP in chronic pain syndrome so that you're left with the slightest touch in that area. A hypersensitivity causes pain. LTP seems to be common throughout the nervous system, how different parts of your brain become more responsive, remember it. So how does LTP work? This has consumed the careers of a gazillion scientists over recent decades trying to sort it out, and people actually by now have a pretty good sense of it. And it is built around a neurotransmitter that is pretty studied at this point. It is interesting for two reasons. A neurotransmitter called glutamate. Glutamate is the most excitatory neurotransmitter ever discovered. What do we mean by that? For the same amount of glutamate coming out as any other neurotransmitter, you get a bigger wave of excitation in that postsynaptic neuron than is provoked by any other neurotransmitter out there. It's the most excitatory neurotransmitter. The second thing about it that is really interesting, that's real important, is glutamate has not one receptor, it's got two types of receptors. And it's this transition to a dual receptor system that begins to explain where you get learning and memory from. So what happens? You release glutamate. What's the most glutamatergic part of the brain? What's the part of the brain where the greatest percentage of synapses use glutamate to speak? You guessed it, hippocampus and cortex. So we're sitting there in the hippocampus, and out comes some glutamate, and it binds to the first type of receptor. And you get your little wavelet of excitation in the postsynaptic neuron, nothing's happening with the second receptor. So you dump a little bit more glutamate out, and you fill up the first receptor. The second receptor doesn't fill up as readily. Fill up the first one, you get another little wavelet. It's not until you get enough glutamate coming in there, it's not until you buzz that first receptor enough times that there's a certain chemical coupling between it and the second receptor, pass a threshold, and the second receptor suddenly responds with a tidal wave of excitation. And suddenly you've got the biggest burst of wavelets going on in that postsynaptic neuron that you ever see in the nervous system. So what have we got? We've got a non-linear system. You get a little bit of glutamate, nothing's happening with the second receptor. You get a moderate amount, nothing's happening. You get a whole lot, nothing's happening. You get a real whole lot, and suddenly it explodes, opens up with excitation. You've got a non-linear system. And this is what learning is. You sit there, a lecturer says something, it goes in one ear and out the other. The lecturer droves on, says again, goes in one ear out the other, says it over and over, and suddenly you get this aha, suddenly the light bulb goes on. That's the moment when there's been enough stimulation in this pathway that you switch over to the second receptor system, you get that explosion coming in. And what that explosion is about is an entirely new ion, one we haven't mentioned before. You remember back a couple of lectures, we're dealing with sodium and chloride and potassium changing directions. The ion that's critical now that comes pouring in is called calcium. Calcium, the same thing that's good for your bones, a little bit of calcium is used up in your brain for this sort of excitation stuff. And when that second receptor gets excited, it allows this tidal wave of calcium to pour in, and that causes tremendous excitation. That's the potentiation. That's that sudden burst, as shown on the chart here. What you've done with this repeated stimulation, is finally dump enough glutamate into the synapses to kick open that second receptor, this calcium-gated receptor, and in goes this tidal wave of enormously excitatory calcium. And you've potentiated this pathway. Hooray for you. So this event has made an impression on you. And what people have shown is repeated stimulation, not stimulation with an electrode in there, but stimulation, a fact coming in over and over, drives those neurons enough to finally cause that calcium influx. So you've just explained the learning part. You've explained how you potentiate this pathway with repeated stimulation. So that's great, but most of us would like to remember the things we've learned for more than 30 seconds. How do you turn it into long-term potentiation? How do you turn it into a memory that will be there an hour from now, by definition, long-term memory, or that will be there in your old age, remembering your childhood language, things of that sort. How do you turn it into a change of synaptic strength that will persist for 3/4 of a century? And an enormous amount of work has gone into understanding where the long-term comes from in long-term potentiation. What we see on this diagram, very schematically, is what goes on. And there's a whole bunch of mechanisms. And what I put down here are 4 of the more common ones. And what you see is in different parts of the brain, LTP involved different of these mechanisms, other ones as well. People make entire careers sniping at each other as to whose mechanism is most important in their part of the brain and whether their version of LTP is the real gold standard LTP. A bunch of things happen, and they make sense. Here what we see on top is our usual synapse pre-LTP, and we got the presynaptic neuron with its neurotransmitters in the vesicles, and we got the receptors on the postsynaptic side, and everybody's happy they're going about its business. How does that influx of calcium now become a long-term signal, a persistent signal, what comes close to being a permanent signal? And the calcium does it in a bunch of ways. First thing that happens, calcium comes rushing in, and you see an interesting thing. It turns out neurons have a whole bunch of spare receptors around. They have them mothballed in storage, sitting there just underneath the surface of that dendritic spine. There are these little bubblet things, these little sort of spheres of membrane that's got all sorts of receptors stuck in there. Do these receptors do anything? No, they're in storage. What calcium does is initiate a pathway by which some of those receptors are pulled out of storage and put onto the surface, put onto that dendritic spine. And what have you got now? More receptors. Metaphorically, you got more ears. Actually, that's a terrible metaphor, but you have more ears at that point. Instead of listening to the presynaptic neuron with 2 receptors, you're now listening with 4. You've increased the sensitivity of that postsynaptic neuron to a signal. The next thing you do, in addition to changing the number of those receptors, is you change their function. And specifically what's done, as shown here by these asterisks in the diagram, is you make a chemical modification in those receptors. For those of you who care about such things, you do something that's called phosphorylation. You basically throw a switch on those receptors so they work differently. How do they work differently? They stay open, activated for a longer time. So for the same amount of glutamate buzzing the system, you not only have more receptors to act upon, the receptors allow more excitation, more of those ions to flow in and out of the neuron. So you've got the postsynaptic neuron listening better, more receptor sensitivity. A third thing happens. And this was actually the first mechanism uncovered to explain LTP. What you could see in this diagram, what may look arbitrary at first, but it's quite intentional, the shape of the dendritic spine changes. In the top picture, we've got the dendritic spine as this very sort of constrained little outpocking. And literally what happens with LTP is the spine flattens out a little bit. And for extremely complex biophysics reasons, what that means is each little wavelet of excitation spreads further than it used to. Technical term, there's less resistance in the membrane, just like in electrical systems, the same wavelet spreads further. And why was this the first mechanism discovered? Because this was before fancy biochemistry, this was before molecular biology. You just need a microscope and you see, aha, neurons from brains that have undergone LTP in the hippocampus, the dendrites have a different shape. And it turns out, when calcium comes in, it causes all sorts of restructuring in that dendrite. You disassemble this whole scaffolding, this superstructure of proteins. The term is the cytoskeleton. You undo the whole superstructure there and rebuild it in a way so that the shape's a little bit different. So now what have you got? You've got a dendritic spine with more receptors that stay open longer, and the wave of excitation sweeps further. One last step, and this one boggled people when this first became clear, when the dendritic spine is stimulated enough, when that calcium wave comes in, what does it do? It releases a neurotransmitter that goes back to the presynaptic neuron and causes it to make more glutamate, causes it to now release more glutamate. Okay, you should be leaping out of your chair in offense and finding your receipt for this course. What's going on? You got neurotransmitters in the dendritic spine being released, going backwards across the synapse. This is heretical. This is a whole new area that people have discovered. Neurotransmitters, unconventional neurotransmitters. These ones are called retrograde neurotransmitters. They go in the wrong direction. There's a way of signaling, what do you know? It turns out the nervous system can communicate in both directions across the synapse. There's a whole bunch of these weirdo neurotransmitters that are made in dendritic spines, and they go backwards. Not only are they weird for where they're found and what direction they go, turns out they're weird in terms of their structure. Some of these are made of gas. For example, there's a neurotransmitter called nitric oxide. Others are made of all sorts of unlikely materials. They're made out of the membrane. These are really weird messengers. They go backwards. They go in the wrong direction. They're made out of unconventional things. But what do? They go back and they stimulate the presynaptic neuron to start making more glutamate. So what have you got here? Four very effective steps. You are now releasing more neurotransmitter out of the presynaptic neuron. There's more glutamate on board. So you're yelling louder, and the postsynaptic neuron is listening more effectively. More receptors stay open longer, more of a spread of that wavelet of excitation. This is what LTP is. This is what a potentiated synapse is about. Now, what's very interesting is from out of nowhere, this turns out to be very relevant to a bunch of neurological diseases. Now, if you talk about glutamate and calcium influx and multiple glutamate receptors, and you're doing this at a meeting of scientists who think about learning and memory, glutamate is your friend. It's the greatest neurotransmitter on earth. It gets you better SAT scores. Meanwhile, over in the next auditorium, if you're sitting with a whole bunch of neurologists and you're talking about glutamate and calcium, it is at the centerpiece of some of the most common of neurological diseases. And this makes sense. What's going on here? So you've got glutamate coming out, and what have we already heard? It's the most excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain. What if glutamate levels get too high? And there's a jargony term in the field given for it. When levels get high enough, you transition from glutamate being an excitatory neurotransmitter to what is called an excitotoxin. If you get too much of the stuff on the scene, you can excite the postsynaptic neuron to death. Through a number of mechanisms, but one that's readily appreciated, how about you do regular old LTP, you get a big wave of calcium, but nothing insane, and what did we see? You undo part of the scaffolding there in the dendritic spine, and you change the shape a little bit. What if you get a massive amount of calcium coming in because of a massive excitotoxic amount of glutamate? You don't just remodel this little dendritic spine. You blow apart the scaffolding in the entire neuron, and it collapses on you, and you got a dead neuron at that point. When does this occur? This is what happens during a stroke. This is what happens during epilepsy. During epilepsy, you've got so much glutamate coming out by this repeated stimulation that you get glutamatergic toxicity. In a stroke, your brain is running out of energy and doesn't have the energy to remove the glutamate from the synapse anymore, and you excite the second neuron to death. This whole world of glutamate excitotoxicity is at the centerpiece of understanding these neurological diseases. Two quick disturbing uh-ohs. One is glutamate, some dietary thing that's resembling MSG, monosodium glutamate. MSG does not get into the adult brain very well. It just gives some of us a headache, but it doesn't get into the adult brain. It gets into babies' brains very well, where it could potentially be excitotoxic. And the FDA long ago banned MSG from babies' food. I grew up in the era of like eating MSG, no doubt, three times a day, and that was probably not a good thing to have happen to my brain. Currently, it is recognized you don't want MSG into the brains of babies. You increase the risk of some excitotoxicity. The other thing, and hopefully I won't get sued for this, is pointing out a compound that structurally is pretty close to glutamate, and this is aspartame. NutraSweet, when it is broken down, it generates a neurotransmitter a lot like glutamate. Nobody can tell you whether consuming a lot of food with NutraSweet is causing brain damage, but enough of it in a lab rat can. It's something to be a little bit worried about. Okay, so we've got the basic workings of the system, and we've got the basic ways in which the system can go awry, could be too excited. Somewhere in there, you have to ask the reasonable question, how do you ever forget anything? Big topic in the field, not at all clear how it works, but in some manner, you need to reverse all the steps we've just seen. So now we see how LTP works. What we begin to look at now is how external factors in your environment can regulate LTP, can make it more likely to occur, can make it less likely, and there's at least two things that are now recognized that enhance LTP, and they both make sense. The first one is lots of energy. If you've got a lot of food in your gut, that translates into a lot of glucose in your bloodstream, which translates into neurons with a lot more energy. Energized neurons are happy neurons, and they can pull off LTP more readily. I mean, think about this massive project. You're dumping glutamate over and over and over, and you got to get it out of the synapse so you don't get excitotoxicity. That reuptake pump is extremely expensive. Lots of energy facilitates LTP. That's a good thing. The next thing is there's a class of hormones which you secrete during stress, and during the first few minutes of stress, these stress hormones make LTP work better. They enhance LTP. And that makes perfect sense. What do we call short-term stress? We call it stimulation. And stimulation enhances memory. That's the whole business that you don't learn very well when you're semi-comatose. You've got to be alert. You've got to be sharpened. That's this whole, you know, flashbulb memory phenomenon. Where were you when you heard that? I'm willing to bet, like most anyone watching this, will remember exactly where they were when they heard the news about which actress had some truly hideous outfit at this year's Oscars. You know, we need some mechanism for remembering the really important stuff in life. These short-term exciting, stimulatory, stressful events sharpen LTP. So that's great. Meanwhile, there's a bunch of things that disrupt LTP. And they're exactly the flip sides of these. Energy depletion makes LTP less likely to occur. What do you know? Being severely hypoglycemic is not a good time to take a final exam in college. LTP synapses don't work as well when you're running out of energy. The whole transport of neurotransmitters, the whole resting potential is disrupted. The next thing is, what if those great stress hormones that enhance memory short term, what if it becomes chronic stress? Anything more than a couple of hours, those same stress hormones now disrupt LTP. And that's why severe stress does very bad things to memory consolidation, memory retrieval. I will just briefly mention a third thing that disrupts LTP, and need do no more than merely mention it because it's obvious and the take-home lesson is clear there. Another thing that messes with LTP dramatically is alcohol. No surprise. Get enough alcohol in your system and you are not LTPing anything, and the next morning you don't remember a thing. Alcohol is not very good for it either. Okay, so now we've got an enormous range of ways in which there's plasticity in the synapse, a number of different mechanisms by which the synapse works differently, learns, remembers, a number of outside factors that modulate such plasticity, energy, stress, some of the things you consume. The last issue, the one we always need to look at this point, is how does LTP differ from one person to the next? And you know immediately what the usual suspects will be. How much glutamate do you release? How much glutamate receptors? What are the ratios of the two types of glutamate receptors? How much calcium? How much you phosphorylate those receptors? All that sort of thing. A couple of really striking examples of how this can work. About 10 years ago, a bunch of scientists at Princeton made a transgenic mouse, a mouse that they manipulated its genes to express more of one type of glutamate receptor. And these mice were the smartest mice anyone had ever seen on Earth. These were brilliant, philosophical, introspective mice. These were mice that they quickly, the scientists sensing a fabulous public relations opportunity, gave a name to. They called this the Doogie Mouse, named after some television character, Doogie Howser, who was, I think, like a six-year-old going to medical school. This was a genetically engineered mouse which had better than average LTP and better than average learning. And this was all over the media, Time magazine on the cover. Manipulate LTP, manipulate the building blocks of it, and you manipulate the ability to learn. Now, at that point, these scientists sat down and did what, in retrospect, was an even more interesting study. They made a different type of genetically engineered mouse. This is one where they knocked out the glutamate receptor, removed the gene for it, so that these were mice that could release glutamate till it was coming out of their ears, and they would not excite that postsynaptic neuron. And these mice were not the sharpest ones on the block. These were very impaired mice, and they were so impaired that they didn't even get some flashy, irresistible name. But these were mice with impaired capacity for LTP and learning. So what seems to be the punchline there? Look at this. You manipulate one single gene and you dramatically change the learning abilities in an organism. Genetic control of cognition, genetic control of intelligence, genes as destiny, not so fast. Then these guys did a really interesting follow-up, showing that these were more than just some mindless molecular biologist futzing with genes. They then took these glutamate receptor impaired mice that couldn't learn anything, and they raised them in an extremely stimulatory environment, and you know what? It completely overcame their deficit. So what initially looked like one big win for nature over nurture and genetic destiny and genetic control over brain function and intelligence, get those mice in the right environment and you overcome that genetic deficit. In other words, if it can happen in a mouse, we've got no excuse to talk about genetic destiny and brain function. Okay, so what have we gotten to here? Just in time for all of us to take a nap now. We now see the functioning of one neuron, how it talks to another one, and most importantly, how that is not set in stone, how our brains, via our synapses, function differently in response to experience. What this sets us up now for in the next lecture is the huge leap now from the functioning of two neurons to networks of neurons. How do networks operate and give us much more complex functions?